Okay, I have started the recording a minute early because I'd like to take a moment to welcome everybody and thank you for joining us here at CIDR. My name is Lynn Anderson and I'll be moderating today's CIDR session. For those of you who are with us for the first time, the CIDR sessions are presented on the first Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m. Mountain Time, Canada. And all of the CIDR sessions, including this one, are recorded and available from the CIDR site. And I'm going to post that URL into the text box so that you can access that. There we go. Now, before we begin, I'd like to point out that we're now using a newer version of Illuminate, and I'm going to quickly go over some of the features for those of you who are new to this platform. Here we go. And as you can see, we have a few changes to the platform, and I'll highlight those. We have, for those of you new, the audio can be accessed from the microphone icon in the bottom left corner by clicking and talking, and then please click on it again when you're done talking. There's a chat window available to everybody if you don't have a microphone or if you just want to text during the session. You can type in a message in the text box and send that message to the entire room, or you can use the drop-down menu to send the message to an individual and then just click on the send button. Also, the participant window allows you to raise your hand if you have a question or comment during the session. You can also applaud John at any time or give him a smiley face at any time there using the icons. And if you have to leave the room for a moment, you can let us know that you are not with us for a few minutes by clicking on the door there with the out arrow and then clicking on it again when you come back. Also, we have a notepad available here in Illuminate. If you look at the top toolbar menu here that I've circled or highlighted, there's a little notepad on the right-hand side, and you can click on that, use that to take notes during the session, and then export those as text files to save for the future. Also, we're going to be using a new feature in our CIDR sessions, and that is a survey, which will pop up at the very end of the session as you leave. Oh, I see we've lost John. And as soon as you exit Illuminate, the survey will pop up. It's very short, and we'd really appreciate you taking a few minutes to fill that out for us. Finally, we have, I'm going to do just a little fun activity here using these tools over here. Specifically, we're going to use the pointer right here. And I'm going to let everybody click on that pointer, and then using this map, click on the map to show us where you're coming from today. So as you can see, I'm in the Toronto area, and I should have used my little flashy there. You should have it almost looks like a mine when you click on the map, and it lets us see where you're coming from. So I'll give everybody a moment. It looks like a wand. Oh, somebody's using the happy face. It might work out better. We might be able to see better if everybody uses the wand with the sparkle at the end of it. And we can see where everybody's coming from. Okay, looks like mostly North America, and we've got one from Ireland. Usually we have a few people from Australia or Europe. Okay. Now I'd like to introduce our presenter for today's session, Dr. John Bagley. John is a professor of educational technology at Athabasca University. He's taught previously at universities in Liverpool, Newfoundland, and Montreal. He's published and edited countless books and articles on distance education and educational technologies, and he was the founding editor of the Learning Media and Technology Journal. John has consulted on the design of educational media campaigns for government and broadcasting organizations in Canada and around the world, and he's a frequent speaker at international conferences. From 2005 to 2009, in fact, he visited 21 Asian countries while advising the distance education projects of the International Research Development Center. In October of 2009, he was an invited speaker at the International Summit on Distance Education, which was held in Beijing, to discuss the survival of distance education in this time of economic recession. So now I'd like to give him the mic so that he can share the highlights of that conference with us and his own research in those Asian countries.
Thank you, Lynn, very much, and I'd like to thank Lynn for all her careful preparation and setting up of this this session. I know she does it every week and every time you have a cyber session, and of course it's so essential to the smooth running. And I was very interested in the comments people were making about the word distant education and flexible learning and so on. I don't think I've told you, Terry, but I was asked to write a chapter for Athabasca Press's next book on flexible learning, and the editor, Cher Gibson, asked if I would make it as witty as possible. So I've written a chapter about inflexible learning and how I hope we will all go back to that. These titles, and that's a joke, of course. You're supposed to realize I'm joking when you read that chapter. But these names are very apposite in that international context because they all mean so many different things to different people. Flexible learning, as Terry Anderson just pointed out, is typically used in Australia. Online learning in India means radio and television and everything converged onto the internet. So it's a very difficult question about the terms that we will maintain. I agree with the comment Noreen just made in the text box. I think distance education remains a very useful catch-all for the types of online learning and blend and flexible learning that don't take place at a distance. I think we need to maintain and promote that distance niche. This is rather relevant to the topic of this session. I'll just pause briefly to make sure you're all hearing okay. Perhaps you could tell me, Lynn, if I'm still coming over okay?
Yes, there's a little static as usual, but I can hear you clearly. And I also want to let everybody know that they have the choice of having the video open or closed if they find it's slowing things down.
Yeah, thank you. So these naming questions that you were just brainstorming just now, they are very relevant to the future of distance education. And it was a topic that came up at this conference. I was very interested to be invited to a conference actually addressing the possible dangers to distance education of recession. The conference obviously was in China. It was organized by the Chinese Radio and Television University, which has recently been renamed the Open University of China. And that reflects several things. It reflects the fact that in China there is distance education is still massively dominated by radio and television. The Open University of China, formerly the Radio TV University, has 3 million students. And if they were focusing on the internet delivery methods, then they wouldn't be able to reach those students. I also visited, while I was there last month, the Chinese Agricultural Broadcast and TV School, which trains farmers, has another 3 million students, which they serve via video, VCDs and DVDs. Again, the internet just doesn't figure in their thinking at all because it doesn't reach people. India, however, I've visited 6 times in that tour of the last few years. India really focuses strongly on promoting the fact that they're modern now, they claim, and they use the internet. But on the rare occasion, relatively rare occasion, that evaluation studies are conducted, we are reminded that the internet is only accessible in the homes of 5% of Indians. And and I think it's about 15% that has easy access through other people or through the workplace. So the internet, these naming issues remind us that the internet isn't the major delivery medium in other parts of the world. And that was an issue that came up at this conference. I've got a long PowerPoint presentation here. Through the miracle of open access to all of those speakers, all of the people at the conference, all of the keynote speakers' PowerPoints, and you too can download them from the address on this display. So I will acknowledge the fact that about half of my slides coming up are highlights of other people's presentations at that conference. So John Daniel spoke very compellingly, as he always does, about open resources and about the need to collaborate internationally on the development of learning materials. And as we go through these slides of six or seven speakers, you'll see that both of those themes recur in the recommendations of international speakers for distance education survival. They're recommending strategies that we should be using in order to guarantee that recession doesn't badly affect us in our distance education world. So John mentioned a number of projects, including this Hewlett Foundation initiative to develop learning materials collaboratively. And he mentioned the other projects that we're well familiar with, One Laptop Per Child, Hole in the Wall, and NAPAD, for example. He emphasized very important, I feel, that these projects do need to be embedded in a framework, not necessarily a theoretical one, but a political one. Countries like China, everything is apparently well coordinated, aligned. Their policies for social development, educational development, distance education development are very well aligned over a number of years. Not the case in Canada, as we know, where educational policy is fragmented and piecemeal, governed largely by the provinces. So again, a big difference between, let us say, Canada and China. China already has a framework for distance education and is promoting it to those millions of people via radio and television, their traditional media which reach everyone. So John Daniel's framework that he concentrated on in this presentation in Beijing relates to the fact that open schooling is a key priority for Sir John at the moment. Open schooling is quite well developed in India, but Sir John maintains that they also need to develop open schooling facilities and frameworks for distance education. Another presentation, which was very valuable, I felt, was by Gajaraj Dhanarajan, who is well known to people in Canada in the distance education world as Professor Raj, and his colleague Patmin Wan. Professor Dhanarajan is the retiring president and CEO of the Wawasan Open University in Penang, which Athabasca people will know collaborates with our university. The incoming chancellor this month, vice chancellor, is Professor Wan, down on the bottom right of this display. And I put this slide in because it illustrates to me one of the fascinating things that you find out about distance education in visiting other countries. In Asia, notably, distance education is a relatively new thing, and they are going into it in ambitious and sometimes quite spectacular, on a spectacular scale. This beautiful old mansion in Georgetown, Malaysia, is the main home of Wawasan Open University, which has an ambitious distance education program, which they hope will attract students from across Asia. Their beautiful new building, as you can see, cuts off the view of the sea from the old building, but both are stunning. I wish we had a nice sea view like that at Athabasca. We have lovely buildings, but We do need to learn from these other universities by going and moving next to lakes. I'll show some other quite spectacular pictures of open universities and distant education universities in Asia later on in this presentation. Dhanarajan and Wang referred to the technological explosion, which Asian distant education now takes for granted. I'll just jump forward to say what the overall conclusions of the conference were. The Western speakers spoke pessimistically about the need for us to develop new strategies for distance education. I didn't hear that from the Asian speakers, and this slide that I'm showing at the moment from the Malaysian speakers reflects the excitement and the ambitious attitudes of Asian distance educators towards the technological explosion and towards the fact that to them television is the natural central feature of distance education. I remember about 3 years ago I wrote that we would soon forget all about learning object repositories because YouTube would soon be the world's learning object repository with the content provided by the students. Well, that's already happening in Asia. In that last in the last 2 years, YouTube has developed, as you probably know, channels for universities. If you are a university, you can apply for a YouTube channel. The first one I saw was from the Virtual University of Pakistan about 2 years ago. And they are now providing this massive worldwide repository of videos to make that television and radio mode of distance education possible and sustainable. And this is an exciting feature to the Asians. They speak, as in this particular presentation, about that technological explosion. I asked somebody if people speaking in Chinese had been speaking with concern about recession, as the Western presenters were speaking. And he said no, he had not heard it in any of the Chinese sessions. He said, I think in China we are in a state of denial about the dangers of recession for distance education. In fact, I think it may not be denial, it may simply be the fact that it doesn't concern them. They're on a solid footing. They have a very wide and variegated set of delivery modes, so they don't seem to feel the need to be concerned about recession. The Western speakers did seem to feel concerned, and I think that raises some interesting questions which I'll cover at the end of this session. I'll gallop through these slides because I want to get on to those final conclusions of my own. The Malaysian Vice Chancellors spoke about the need for open access, open courseware. There was a presentation by Martin Vidal, who is the director of the Vice President of the Eden Network in Europe. And she too spoke about open education resources, the powerful impact of it. I think about Abaska, due to the work of Terry and other people, the president, in developing the open press that Athabasca now has, we are well poised in Canada to be a leader in that international open educational resources field. Martin Vidal also spoke about the importance and the efficiency of radio and television services, and that is something that I feel we need to learn from the Asians, notably the Chinese. We need to learn about how they are sustaining and developing radio and television. People with a long enough memory in distance education, my memory of educational technology goes back through a career of 38 years, as recently as 15 years ago. Sorry, 15 years ago, radio and television were marginalized in our culture. Well, they seem to be crawling their way back in, and if we wish to take place, play a part in that international field of distance education, I feel strongly that we need to restore some of those basic radio and TV delivery methods in order to be compatible with other countries and to share courses with them. A Denise Kirkpatrick is the Pro-Vice Chancellor at the Open University in Britain. She spoke directly about recession because, of course, in Britain they are so absorbed by it. It's a dreadful state of affairs in England in relation to unemployment. The question arising out of this presentation is whether the usual thing will happen to us in the world of distance education. As employment rises, of course, we traditionally expect student numbers to go up, but that doesn't seem to be happening at the moment, most likely because students no longer have the funds to take distance education courses to fill in their time when unemployed. Denise Kirkpatrick spoke about this unemployment issue and its dangers for distance education. She also spoke about mobile learning, which is, of course, a strong suit in the research agenda of the Open University of the UK. President Susan Aldridge of University of Maryland University College spoke also about the importance of acting and thinking globally to reach out to students and faculty, and that means building partnerships to share course materials, something that her college in Maryland is evidently doing as a top priority. Developing and encouraging multinational distance education collaborations. At Athabasca, President Panacook and Vice President Academic Margaret Forhey are putting a great amount of store by international collaborations. And one of the activities that I was able to pull off on behalf of the university while I was in Beijing was the signing of a memorandum of agreement with Beijing Normal University, which will look at these issues, of course, sharing. I'm just noticing that Rory and other people are making comments.
Rory,
and
feel
I'll
free to grab the mic at this point to expand on your question.
Hello, everyone. I guess my question is pretty clear. You seem to see a difference between radio and television, and what I'm seeing happening is that the internet is the radio and television are going on the internet, and I don't think that the big networks or anyone see that there's going to be much difference in even as little as 5 or 10 years. So I'm wondering how you see the difference or what is the difference between podcasting on the internet and television or live internet?
Yeah, thanks, Rory. I don't see a difference at all. I think we do tend to see those two areas as different here in Canada. Radio and television is something we've largely forgotten about. We think of distribution of audio and video in terms of podcasts and vodcasts via the internet. Most of those Asian countries can download those materials within the administrative centres of the universities, and they can then redistribute them, podcast, vodcast type delivered material, with radio and TV information on DVDs. People in learning centres across China and India receive those. As a result of which, I don't feel that people in Asia do see any difference at all. They see however the material arrives at head office, it can all be put onto a DVD. We think of those media in terms of different distribution systems, but they have an integrated system whereby they collect and distribute the materials together. I think it would be useful for us to think more in those terms, whereby there is little or no difference between all those media. And the definition of online in India fits that. Fits, I believe, what I'm saying there, because the Indians regard online education as the convergence of all media on the internet. I hope we can aspire to that. Thank you for those points in the text box. I'll move ahead quite quickly. And Brian is absolutely correct that internet broadcasting is more effective for low numbers, how can we find the break-even point with TV and radio? I remember how the Open University in England did that in 1978. They realized that for the last 10 years they had been distributing programs in the small hours of the morning on national television. They were only being received or viewed by 3 dozen people. So at that point, 10 years in, they decided that it was far more cost effective to send them audio tapes. We do need to establish, and I hope it doesn't take us another 10 years as it did in those early days of the OU in England, to establish the cost effectiveness of the different media. Carl Holmberg is Secretary General of the International Council on Distance and Open Learning, and he spoke at the conference in Beijing, also emphasizing increasing globalization and internationalization. In other words, they were all saying that if we don't forge alliances between North American distance education and open universities in other parts of the world, we may fall behind those other parts of the world. I've saved this set of highlights till last because to me, this lady, Sara Guri Rosenblit, from the Open University of Israel, addressed the theme of the conference very clearly indeed, and I've selected half a dozen of her slides. She was the only speaker that I heard, that is not to say that there were not others in parallel sessions, but this lady was the only speaker that I heard in a plenary session who looked ahead to distance education in 30 years' time and saw that if it had not fulfilled these criteria, it would not survive. At least our definition, our current North American, European, Australian definition of distance education would not survive. I won't go down all of those because I'm sure by now you've read them, but transnational education and international trade in higher education, which largely to me and to those other speakers that I've just summarized, means trading in courseware. I had an email this morning from Korea, which is very interested in Athabasca's syllabus, curricula, not from the technological point of view, because they have an elaborate TV distribution system in Korea, but from the point of view of the courseware. 40 years on, Athabasca has a gold mine, a richly pedagogically designed resource in terms of courseware. This is something universities such as Athabasca can promote in terms of trading courseware with other nations in order to share students and to increase student enrollment. Dr. Guri Rosenblatt covered the dangers that may happen in this pressured context of recession, diploma mills. I think we're seeing a bit of that for ourselves in terms of the packaging of courses under different headings, different subject headings, different diplomas and certificates can be packaged around the same courses, which does run the serious risk of making us susceptible to criticism about being a diploma mill. Dr. Rosenblatt pointed out that we have to avoid these risks in this new pressured recession situation. Once again, the lady from the Open University of Israel stressed the importance of the open source and open access materials. She too referred to radio and TV universities. In most of those countries I've visited in Asia, the 21 countries over the last few years, supervising projects, radio and television is a priority in even the poorest of universities because those media reach the public and the students. Obstacles, as Dr. Rosenblatt pointed out, include the ever-increasing digital divide between the haves and have-nots. Now, I've reached the end of the selection that I have made from those papers that you can download from the web. if you return manually to, at the end of the presentation, to slide number 2, I think it is, then you'll find that PowerPoint list, that source of PowerPoints for that conference in Beijing. I want to show a few pictures, however, that to me illustrate what's happening in distance education in that in the Asian continent. This picture is a university I visited twice in Seoul in the last year, and to me, quite simply, it is the most stunning university I've ever seen. That is just one of their buildings. It looks like Westminster Abbey, but it's I believe it's their administration building. This looks like Buckingham Palace or the White House. It's one of their departmental buildings. That university has been around for 60 years and it's thriving on the riches of South Korea. It's now regarded as number one among the 18 cyber universities in South Korea. Cyber university simply means the to them it means the customizing of their programs for online access. When I was in that university recently, I was asked to give a presentation in one of their studios. Now that little studio, this is the view from the presenter's desk. It's not very spectacular until you realize that there's a line of about 24 of these studios and there's professors coming in and out every day, all day, broadcasting live to all the students, both on campus and off campus. So some of the questions that were raised in the discussion before this session began about the merging of on-campus and distance education. Yes, it's already happened in some of those countries. And in Korea, the lecturers have to prepare their materials with a huge team of instructional designers. They have to do that every week for 13-week courses. Their materials are distributed in the same way as we distribute ours in terms of print material at Athabasca, but they are also accompanied by lectures on the web, not unlike this one, not much more elaborate than this one. They can inject video and so on. I gave this little lecture to I don't know how many thousand students across Korea. Within 5 minutes of the finish of that lecture, I was given a DVD with the whole lecture on it. And that to me that was impressive because it demonstrates the complete coordination of their integrated services. I just noticed Brian's comment about interactivity during lectures. That continues to be a weakness unless one considers the fact that the broadcast mode is blended with online and print. So there is interactivity subsequent to the lectures, but I talked to them in Korea about that, and they're working on it. It's a very easy matter to inject interactivity technically. The only trouble is there are thousands of students, which makes it rather difficult. Ray is saying in Nova Scotia, distance education by radio and TV in Asia reflects their teaching style and local cultures. It doesn't mesh with constructivist pedagogy. They are quite hostile, my impression is, to what we call constructivism. On the other hand, I think some of their attitudes are to do with the age-old issue among teachers of not wanting to change their autocratic habits. So authoritarian, one-way style lectures aren't what the students want in Asia. And I'll tell you why I know that. I know that because, and I think Rory may be able to say something about the IDLC. I believe you were there yesterday, Rory, in Ottawa. The IDLC asked me to spend the last few years supervising projects in these Asian countries, distance education collaborative research. Those projects involved a number of questionnaires and evaluation and needs assessment studies. Result of those was that the students in Asia don't want that one-way determinist type of lecture style where the teacher stands on the platform or pontificates online or in a videotape without interaction. The students actually want a more interactive style of education. So I think the differences, and Ray raises an important question here about teaching style and local cultures. My attitude, my belief now after those 5 years in Asia, is that people are the same the world over, that there are no essentially different deep Confucian learning styles, whatever philosophies you want to attribute to the differences that do exist between those countries, but there clearly are different teaching traditions, and I think there will be a need to overcome some of those attitudes in Asia in order for the students to be more involved. And as Rory is pointing out, the IDRC in Ottawa, that's the International Development Research Center, is has picked up in a very dynamic way on the importance of distance education in the developing countries, and they are emphasizing agricultural and health education methods. So people in this session who are interested in possible funding or acting as consultants in those fields could contact the IDRC or Rory or me for the people you ought to go to. And they have also developed an international priority for open courseware in their funding priorities. These were the tasks that the IDRC asked me to address: training Asian distance educators in research and evaluation methods and coordinating. There's 10 projects in all, each involving 3 or 4 Asian countries. There were several publications came out of that. In 2007 we had a special edition of the journal called Distance Education, which covered the preliminary stages of those Asian projects. I've maintained this one slide from my thousands of Asian slides because to me it represents the differences between us and them. Western distance education infrastructure and Asian distance education infrastructure. This this tool, you recognize it as Moodle. You won't be so familiar perhaps with the video camera module in there. But I took this picture in Mongolia, which is a wonderful country, and it was one of my top 2 favorites out of the 21 I visited. Mongolia is a dynamic, adventurous place, very poor, but working so hard to solve its poverty issues via distance education. And they have developed with people in Sri Lanka this video plug-in module for Moodle. And I know that that our technical staff in Athabasca are interested in adding such features. There is nothing to stop Moodle becoming a far more shareable international medium for distance education. So finally, I think I've got about 5 minutes, and I'll finish with my own perceptions of the situation, which are largely acquired in that quite illuminating, inspiring 5 years I spent in Asia. This is what Vineshki said in 2000. In the medieval community, the poor sat beneath the salt, below the salt. You may know that phrase. They couldn't reach the salt, which was on the top table. And so they sat disenfranchised and defined as have-nots. As Vineshki pointed out 10 years ago, that is equivalent, he predicted, to the have-not situation that will be developed by our Western emphasis on internet delivery. Millions of people will sit offline, disconnected, below the salt in that sense. I took a picture. I gave a talk at the beautiful University of Durham in Northern England last year, and they put me up in the Bishop's Palace, and that's now a hall of residence, and in the morning I sat on the top table and had my cornflakes looking down on those poor students who were below the salt. I'm sitting here today talking on Illuminate. I sympathize with all those students who don't have access to Illuminate. These were my summary comments at the Beijing conference, and I'll end with them now. I was asked to chair and present on the topic of building the capacity of distance education management to survive recession. Especially as Rory McGill is here, and he's one of the executives of Athabasca University, I will point out that I began by saying that the capacity of Athabasca University's management is to survive recession is very well developed, and they don't need any help from me. I think I've already illustrated that by pointing out that that Athabasca is moving ambitiously into areas of course sharing, international collaboration, for example, and in the open field. Those are the three areas that this Beijing conference stressed. But what I have observed is that over the years, not just in Asia, but over the years I've spent in education technology and distance education, we cannot take for granted the survival of any delivery system. I would even go so far as an author did in one of the recent editions of Irrado to say that online education as we know it might suddenly disappear for good reasons, just as educational television disappeared for good reasons. We can't take for granted that any form of distance education will survive. We already are finding, my second point, that Asian universities are better set up in terms of infrastructure than we are. The question that I can't see back up the text box, I think it was Ray, raised the question of constructivist delivery. Well, that model is not at current, not at present well accepted in Asian countries because they don't believe it is relevant to them. They don't have the infrastructure, the interactive distance education infrastructure yet that we have. I'm utterly convinced, however, that rich universities like the one I showed you in Korea will have that within a year or two. At that point, it will be more relevant to apply Western models in their culture. But the converse of point two is that non-Western models could be very important for distance education in the Western world. I think we are now seeing, without a doubt, that we live in the undeveloping world. Those countries in other parts of the world are forging clusters. We will have to conform to their models and their delivery methods, I believe strongly, if we are to survive indefinitely. I already touched on this when somebody raised the issue earlier. Are there differences in global learning style? I don't believe there are. And when I started going to Asia 5 years ago, I really wanted to respect their learning and teaching styles, their Confucian philosophy of teaching. But having seen all those results from student evaluation studies, evaluations of student attitudes, I'm now convinced that there are no learning style differences, but there are huge differences in teaching style. And many of those teaching styles are ill-founded, and I think it's the teachers we need to address on this. We see a big division between the East and the West in distance education terms. In terms of technology versus pedagogy, we are strong on the pedagogy in the Western world. But they are stronger on the technologies. So this is coming towards my final conclusion. If we want to survive in westernized distance education, we will have to, this is what those speakers were repeatedly saying at the Beijing conference, we will have to make sure that our courseware is marketable. And that means making sure that we are using a broad range of delivery methods which make our courses compatible with those universities which use a wider range of media. And finally, it's just disappearing off the bottom of my screen, so I'm not sure if you're seeing it well, but I suggested at that conference in Beijing, we need to develop new models while maintaining old ones. What has happened in the Western world over the last 15 to 20 years is we've developed new online models while jettisoning the old models. And that's okay now because so many people in our countries have internet access. But that's never going to be the case in the Asian world, which is why they are enthusiastically developing new models, online methods, but they are also maintaining and preserving their traditional media. And that, with old models maintained while new models are developed, it seems pretty clear to me that they are going to have a stronger basis for converging their media, as is already happening in India, in China, Japan, Korea and Taiwan, those more affluent countries in Asia. So I think that's all. Here's some quick references. You can download these from PandoraAsia.com. The first two books the second two books are just about to be published by Sage, summarizing those IDLC projects. They've been translated already. They're already translated into four or five open source languages in open source versions. So you can download the English version from that website under publications. As Dr.
Thanks goes to you, John. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us today to discuss your experiences and your research in Asia and some of the results from the conference that you attended. We really appreciate you enlightening us on what you've learned while on your travels. So thank you so much for that. And I know in the last few minutes here there was many, many comments and questions coming up in the text box. And I'd like to give some of those people an opportunity to pose those questions again, hopefully using your audio. If you don't have audio, then please type those questions in again because it's difficult to scroll through and get on top of what went by already.
I would just like to make a quick comment regarding the technology versus the pedagogy. There seems to be a piece in there that's really missing, and that's the instructional design, because they need to go together.
Yes, and that is a commodity that we can offer to other countries. That is a commodity that makes us attractive to those developing and newly developed countries. We had some visitors at Athabasca University from a Chinese university recently who sat quite impassively during our descriptions of the delivery systems we use. So the moment we referred to instructional design and to the fact that that is a strength at Athabasca University, they pricked up their ears and showed interest. They have instructional designers in those countries, but one of those Pandora IDRC projects I advised. It did a survey of instructional designers across open universities in Asia. And one of the results, a major result, is that those instructional designers are using textbooks and are trained from textbooks, American textbooks, which are probably 25 years old, like Fleming and Levy, Dick and Carey. Trained in principles of instructional design which don't relate to the new media at all. And they're very lacking in confidence, those Asian instructional designers. They really do want to learn from us about the principles we use. Brian is asking to what extent is cost an issue. To make education more available, we have to drive down costs. And that is a major argument, I suggest, for justifying Athabasca's ambitious efforts to develop shareable courses and course sharing joint course development collaborations with other universities in Asia. That will drive down the cost. I've even heard a suggestion in Athabasca that we could outsource our course development, video aspects of our course development to Asian universities in order to keep our costs down, because we would be creating a reciprocal arrangement which could make our skills and strengths marketable. Rob is asking, in my travels, did I find any schools that did mathematics distance education specifically? Yes, in India they have a very well-developed distance-based online curriculum, and you could find details, I would think, Rob, at the website of the NOS, the National Open School in India. I've not checked that, but I would be fairly sure you could do that. And some of the early development projects which those core countries like Mongolia have been attempting in terms of mobile education, they stress three topics, English as a second language and mathematics as a cell phone delivered, and cell phone delivered courses. They also are developing interesting bridges between the cell phone and the web in those countries. Brian is pointing out absolutely correctly, constructivism may be expensive, requires a lot of input, and that is really explains why the Chinese may not be able to develop a real priority for learner-centered methods. Their tutors are absolutely stretched, as one might imagine, at any university with 3 million students. The Open University of China, with its over 3 million students, is not in a good position to develop that sort of interactivity. Please take me up if I've missed anybody's points or questions here. Thank you, Terilyn, and it's very good to see Terilyn back in action. She has had a nasty car accident, and I'm very glad to see her here.
I'm just scrolling back in the text box to see if there's any questions or comments we've missed, but in the meantime, please feel free to grab the mic if you have a question to pose to John. Okay, well, I'll take this moment then to just mention our next CIDR session, which will be on Wednesday, January 6th at 11 a.m. Mountain Daylight Time. So, and that's with Norm Vaughan from Mount Royal University and Dr. Michael Power from Laval University. They came up with the title Blended Online Learning Design, Shaken, Not Stirred. And they'll be discussing the research they've been doing on blended programs, which actually came up prior to this session. So hopefully you can join us for that in the new year. Oh, also, I see there are a few people leaving the room. I just want to, because I know everybody's got other commitments, I just wanted to remind you that as you leave the Illuminate room, a survey is going to pop up, and we'd really appreciate it if you took a few minutes to fill that out for us. And thank you, everybody, who was able to join us for this session, and have a very Merry Christmas and Happy New Year or Happy Hanukkah, whatever your celebration may be in December. Thank you. And thank you again, John.
Thank you, Lynn, and everybody, and happy festive season to you all, and I'm out of here. Bye-bye.
Hi, John. Before you go, I just remembered that somebody in the, I think it was Gina, asked for a link to, and I'm trying to remember what she asked for a link to. Gina, can you please type it in again for John?
I'll just find that link to the video module. If you'd like, is it Gina you say? If you'd like to type your email address, I'll send you that picture. And I'll just spend a couple of minutes now looking for the download about that module's development. Good, thank you. I'll send you the picture to Dennis at CMTR. I'm now looking for the download address. And I'm still looking, not